get. We talked a little bit about particle detectors, and we actually talked about, well, measuring fields is complicated. So to measure fields, we need to introduce, what we actually do in reality is to couple systems to fields. And those systems, through their coupling, acquire correlations with the field, and then we measure those systems. Okay? There's no such thing as a projective measurement carried out directly on a quantum field. That's not the way we operate. That's not the way we measure fields. And there are some formal problems with them that we briefly discussed in the last lecture. So what we did is we obtained, as a model of particle detector, we discussed that a good particle detector would be localized in space and time. And they would couple, so it would be a first quantized system, something that we don't have problems making projective measurements on. And it also should be something that couples to the field, right? And then we discussed, well, you know, I mean, what are our particle detectors made of? Our particle detectors in nature, the ones that we use in physics, in experimental physics, are made of atoms. Those atoms get excited. And then through those excitations, we engineer mechanisms that can actually detect that as a click. So we looked at a hydrogen atom and the light-matter interaction as a possible model for particle detectors, or at least to inspire. So it's definitely a particle detector of the electromagnetic field, or a detector of the electromagnetic field. And then today we're going to see how that inspires other models of detection. We also mentioned that in quantum optics, people tend to use majoritarily, and that's what you will find in textbooks, this model here, the James Cummings model, okay, for a particle detector that we would analyze a little bit and we'd compare with the one that we derived from first principles. Now, recapping, the interaction Hamiltonian between the atom and the field can be written as this, which is a dipole operator product with the electric field. It's cage independent, so it's nice. The dipole operator has this form. So the atom is localized in here, is localized in space. We haven't talked about the time localization yet. We will today. But let's just talk for now about the spatial localization. This atom doesn't live everywhere. We know that atoms are not everywhere, sort of, meaning that they're strongly localized. In fact, when you talk about atoms, hydrogen-like atoms, we know exponentially localized. And that localized nature shows up through this smearing vector that we have here. This smearing vector of the atom is related to the wave functions of the excited and the ground state, the transition we're looking at, the excited and the ground state, as follows here. So wave function of the excited state, wave function of the ground state, and then the X vector. All right? So this is what we came up with out of first principles for a model of particle detector. Now, today, you can work with it to detect the electromagnetic field. And in fact, you can describe physics with it, like the physics of atoms coupled to electromagnetic fields. Although people in atomic physics and in quantum optics don't really use that one. It's too complicated to use, so people do approximations. Still solvable, though. I mean, we're going to talk about results. We actually compute these things. But then again, the calculations could be easily, when summarized, something like 30 pages or something like that. So it's definitely a complicated model to work with. And maybe there's a simpler model that captures the same features of the light-matter interaction and also that can be generalized to other fields and capture in general the physics, I guess, the fundamental physics of a particle detector. And we're going to introduce today the Andrew DeWitt model. Let me give you a year to get a sense of when this was introduced. So kind of 1976. Although that's the Andrew part of it, the DeWitt part of it is the 80s, early 80s, maybe 80, even 1980, I can check it for sure. Now, if I'm checking one, why shouldn't I check the other? 79, almost. Okay, so the Andrew DeWitt model is, okay, so this is the coupling of a particle detector to a vector field. Right, can we construct an analog of this coupling to a scalar field? So the scalar analog of this. Say that we're not that interested in exchange of angular momentum. Sometimes it would be interesting, sometimes, but not most of the times. So let's just come up with a scalar version of this. Scalar version of this for an interaction Hamiltonian would be, okay, so I have a coupling strength. Let me call it lambda. I have some integral over space. A dipole operator, what do you think is going to be replaced by if we're looking at scalar coupling?
Charge.
What's that?
Charge.
Yeah, a monopole operator. Oh, sorry, I'm going too fast. I want to get relativistic as soon as possible. Mu of t, and that couples to a scalar field. So as you can see, this is pretty obviously a scalar version of this Hamiltonian. Then again, let me write the monopole operator. The monopole operator. We don't have a smearing vector now. We have a smearing function. It's a scalar, not a vector. Oh, sorry. And in this case, let me assume it's real. We have spherical symmetry. If we were describing orbitals, those ones can be expressed in terms of real functions. But then again, let's just for simplicity assume it's real. So we get sigma plus all right. And this f of x is a smearing function. That gives us an idea of how localized this detector is. Now, if you want to model somehow atomic physics with this simplified model, you need to pick your smearing function wisely, the one that comes from the process that you want to describe. But then again, in general, what we have here is a model that couples to the field, to the scalar field, in a localized region, because you assume this F has some support, or at least is strongly supported in a finite region, like an atom is. Now, this is not quite the original Andrew DeWitt model. The original Andrew DeWitt model is more of the form lambda mu, keep doing the same, pi, which is a particular case of that when the smearing function is a delta function, so a point-like atom. That's the way it was first introduced by DeWitt. So a little bit of history. Andrew, that the reason they introduced it, by the way, is not to describe the light-matter interaction. That is in parallel to what they were doing. They didn't care too much about that. And if I'm wrong, maybe Andrew will tell us one day. He comes here often. But the first motivation they had is like, look, some people are dissatisfied with the original derivation of the Andrew effect, which we will see in these lectures. The original derivation had some caveats. So you know what? I want to be able to obtain information about quantum fields without having to rely on changes of basis, and these are the number of particles that will be created here and here. Concepts that are a little bit blurry when you don't have operational means to actually quantify them. As we will see, those caveats we will see. So Andrew said, OK, I'm going to introduce some system, some quantum system that allows me to do a localized measurement of the field. I don't care if it's reproducing physics too much, like atomic physics, but I just want to measure a field localized. And then Andrew said, how about I put a cavity that contains a field, and then that cavity couples to another field that permeates that cavity. That was the original Andrew detector. And then DeWitt said, look, instead of a cavity, why don't we use like a two-level system? It's much simpler, and it does the same function. The philosophy we want is just, OK, we want something that couples, you know, the characteristic of a particle detector, something that couples locally to the field, something that couples to the field in a way that is easy, like linear, for example, and something that, in principle, is non-relativistic in ways, meaning that something that is two levels and nice and not a field, not extended too much, although you can argue that this is an extension, but something that we can do projective measurements over. Okay? So they introduce it without relating it with the light-matter interaction. But it so happens that it's capturing all the ingredients of the light-matter interaction, except perhaps for things that involve exchange of angular momentum, because this is a vector interaction, this is a scalar interaction. Now, they also want it to be localized in time. So maybe it's better to write an interaction Hamiltonian that has a switching function. Switching function controls how strong the interaction is, this psi,
of, sorry, this chi of t is a switching function. It's a function that varies in time and in principle can be supported only in a region. So you control the time of the interaction. In atomic physics, you can say atoms are always coupled to the electromagnetic field. Yeah, yes and no. You can prepare the experiment and you can initialize your experiment. You can keep your atom in a Faraday cage if you want, or you can get your atom to enter a cavity where a field lives. Or you can go fancy and do superconducting atoms, superconducting circuits, and artificial atoms, and then they can actually switch it on and off the way they want. So we will discuss a little bit about how these things are implemented in light-matter interactions, but the idea here is that we have some time localization. If we add it to this Hamiltonian too, we get just simply we get a detector, a particle detector that is localized in space and time. Okay, questions about it? All right. So this scalar field here, I can write in arbitrary dimensions, space-time dimensions, in an expansion in a particular basis. I can pick up, so in general, I can write it in any basis of solutions. I mean, you've done field quantization, I hope. So this, you can treat classically as a general solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And then the Klein-Gordon equation, the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, we second quantize by imposing canonical commutation relationships. And that yields, if we pick a basis of plane waves, that is not necessary, but we can, just to give an expression, this thing would look like nx squared root 2 pi n. N is the number of spatial dimensions, by the way, as is tradition when we write this kind of Hamiltonians, because we are already in a particular time slice, though, and we will discuss that when we get covariant here. So this n is the number of spatial dimensions, so we have an n plus one dimensional spacetime. Okay, so this thing is a dagger k. Oh, did I write an x? I mean a k. And I'm missing the modulus k here. All right, and then I get a dagger sub k, e to the I, kx, say that is okay, kx minus modulus kt, minus, no, this is a plus, so this is a minus plural, kt, plus the Hermitian conjugate. Now, I'm assuming the field is massless. It could be massive. That's no problem. The most interesting stuff that we will discuss is also simpler when the field is massless, massless field. Scalar, real field. Okay. All right. So we have this detector model that we've arrived, remember, by first principle light-matter interaction, and then we build the scalar version of it, and we added the ability to switch on and off the interaction, to localize it in time. Okay? That's the model we had. Now let's compare this with the James Cummins model. Again, we talked about the James Cummins model a little bit, and we said, yeah, it's kind of built from intuition, as in like, yeah, we get, so this is an operator for the atom that gets from the ground state to the excited state, as you remember. This is an operator from the field that annihilates a photon of frequency omega. Again, the use of word photon is liberal here, as we will discuss later. We have a sigma minus here, which takes the excited state of the atom to the ground state. The A dagger, which is a creation operator that creates a photon. So it's kind of based on a very classical intuition, as in like, right, if there's a photon in the field, it can be absorbed by the atom and get excited. If the atom is excited, it can emit a photon to the field. That's the intuition. In fact, if omega, remember, omega is the energy gap of the detector. It's right here. Omega is the energy difference between the excited state and the ground state. Okay? So here they're saying, okay, say that the atom only emits energy to the mode that is resonant with, the one that has the same frequency, or in any way is very peaked around that. So this omega and this omega would be roughly the same. And the process that we have is of the form
sigma plus A dagger, A sigma minus A dagger. Those are the processes that are allowed through the Hamiltonian.
Now, if we look at the light-matter interaction, we see that we don't have quite that, right? We had a product of sigma plus with sigma with A, for sure, we have that. But we also have sigma plus with A dagger. And we also have sigma minus with A. So those things are present and are not here in the James Cameron Hamiltonian. So people wave their hands in many ways to try to reason why that is not there in this Hamiltonian. Let's just follow the usual not so right reasonings that people give, and then we will understand them better. This thing doesn't move today, but I can assist it locally in time, and then it works, which is good. And then I want the one behind to come down. Yeah. All right. So maybe I should do the middle first for organizational purposes. All right. So very roughly, people write Hamiltonians like this. Say again?
That second term in the James
Cameron. Oh, I can't see by the reflection. Second term, yes.
Should that second one also be bigger?
The sign is there on the wrong spot. Sorry, that was my bad. Thank you. I only hope it doesn't just fall on my head. Okay, so the James Cameron Hamiltonian versus the structure of something like the Andrew DeWitt. Okay? Then James Cummins is of the form sigma plus A plus sigma minus A dagger. And Andrew DeWitt is schematically of the form sigma plus sigma minus multiplying A plus A dagger. This one is kind of reasonable, even if you think of this as a harmonic oscillator or something, because this thing is sigma x. Let me put hats on them. I've been doing it so far. That thing is sigma x, and it couples to the x operator, roughly, of the harmonic oscillator. So it's kind of reasonable, an observable of the atom coupled to an observable of the field mode, right? But that's not what people do in the James Cummins. They do this. This thing, if you expand, of course, has terms sigma plus A dagger plus sigma plus A plus sigma minus A plus sigma minus A dagger. Now, people say often, yeah. And you will hear it if you actually go around like basic textbooks in quantum optics. This term and this term, let me call them counter rotating terms. And they say often, well, these two terms don't conserve energy, they say. And let me put it in quotes, because that's not what I would say. And they say, they reason it like this. So imagine that I have an initial state that is excited ground, sorry, excited zero. So no photons in the field, and excited state of the atom through the Andrew DeWitt Hamiltonian, through the term, say, sigma minus A dagger, I can have a process that is ground, one. And also you have the conjugate process to that. Now they say, right, I have an energy h bar omega here and an energy h bar small omega here. If omega, big omega and small omega are the same because it's resonant, that conserves energy in the process, they would tell you. Right? The energy was in the atom, now it's in the field. Very reasonable with words. And they say, well, the counter-rotating terms
allow for things like this. Ground and zero through this term, okay, you get two excited and one. And if you start with an energy that is zero here, then you move to an energy that is omega plus omega with an H bar because I've been writing them here. And then people say, yeah, that doesn't conserve energy because there's no excitations here at all. And then suddenly I have both the atom and the field excited. So you will hear sometimes that people say, those terms with an army of quotes, yeah.
Like, I don't think people get rid of those terms because they don't preserve energy. They get rid of them because they oscillate really quickly compared to the frequency.
I agree, and we're going to see that. Yeah, for sure. But I'm not saying that you don't know or quantum opticians don't know.
But, I mean, like, I do agree that people make statements like those terms don't preserve energy, but they don't use that as motivation to get rid of those terms.
Fair enough. I have heard as motivation to get rid of them, like, not once. I mean, I had a... I sat through two courses of quantum optics as a master's student, and I heard this twice. But yeah, and again, no, cool. They know where they come from, for sure. But the point being that's an argument that people made, and we have to debunk it because we shouldn't allow people make those arguments when they're not right. Right. So and it's also instructive, I think, to think of why this is not a violation of energy conservation or anything like that. When people say that, some say. Counter-rotating terms do not preserve energy. Because of this. Now, if someone tells you that, would you be able to spot what the problem in the argument is? I mean, to begin with, it's easy to see this Hamiltonian as written here. Just written like this. It's not time-dependent explicitly, right? Therefore, it preserves energy. Indeed, through time evolution, it will preserve the expectation value of energy. I'll give you too much there. And the James Cameron Hamiltonian, same thing. Both of them preserve energy, have energy conservation. So why is this kind of reasoning not right? So why is it failing? If I write this and I tell you, look, these don't preserve energy, these do, what would you say? Would you say anything? So first thing I would say is, hold on, but what is energy anyways, right? I have a free Hamiltonian for the detector. And the free Hamiltonian, I said, is two levels separated by an energy gap omega. So the Hamiltonian is just omega, sigma plus sigma minus. The ground state has zero energy. The excited state has omega energy. And I also know the free Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator uncoupled too. So this thing goes roughly like omega A dagger A. Right? It's a harmonic oscillator. So the ground state has zero energy. First excitation, omega. Second, 2 omega. So equal spacing of the levels. These two Hamiltonians, this thing is proportional to sigma z. Sigma z and sigma x, do they commute? They don't. What about the x operator and the number operator? Do they commute? They don't. So if my interaction Hamiltonian does not commute with my free Hamiltonian, then they cannot be diagonalizing the same basis. And this thing is only an eigenstate of the free Hamiltonian. It's not an eigenstate of the full interaction Hamiltonian plus free Hamiltonian because they don't commute. The fact that this is an eigenstate of the free one is enough to say that it's not an eigenstate of the full interaction. So assigning a value of energy for this thing is fake. That thing doesn't have a definite value of energy when we consider the full Hamiltonian. Also, that's not really a process that happens unless you measure. The evolution will take you to a superposition of things that contain both. Okay? So this argument of energy conservation, if you ever hear it, just say it's not right out of hand. Okay? Any questions about that? Again, yeah, I know
Of course, quantum opticians know about that. But students starting to learn quantum optics, sometimes they don't. Because that thing is heard, I promise. I mean, I've heard it. All right, so the James Cummings model seems to be a little bit problematic in the sense, at this point, in the sense that we just, out of hand, crossed out two terms because we wanted, in this classroom, because we wanted, the way it's presented, what is the rationale to do it? Can we actually do it? We know the real interaction, and the real interaction has processes like that. By the way, news. Yes, it is possible to get an atom in the ground state, the vacuum of the field, and see the atom excite by emitting a photon. Those things can be observed. That is fine. I mean, people go all crazy waving their hands about quantum fluctuations, so there you go, one. We will see it properly, though. So is there any way? Of course, this model is used in quantum optics, which actually means it works. It describes experiments. And then you can have this argument about who knows better, first principles theoretical physics or the experiment. And the experiment will win every time. So we need to find a way. We need to find a way to see how this thing actually emerges from the first principle of physics. All right, this is what we're going to do today. Or yeah, hopefully we'll do today. OK? Questions? All right.
If those terms are negligible, then the other one also.
Say again?
If those terms are somehow negligible, then the.
That's exactly what you're going to see. When are they negligible? They are not negligible always. And in fact, in RQI, they're negligible almost never. If the if you want to do, and we will discuss that, if you do an approximation like that, you destroy the covariance of the model. A model that was relativistic is no longer relativistic. So in any setup that relativity matters, this model would not be good. We're going to see under what circumstances you can actually do this kind of approximation in the next slide. So the slides. Blackboard slide, if you want. OK? Yeah, of course. In most processes, that thing is those terms are going to be, the effect of those terms is going to be negligible, but let's see how. And to do that, let's do it with an example. Let's compute. Oh. All right. Let's compute the vacuum excitation probability of a detector. By the way, if we compute the vacuum If we compute the vacuum excitation probability of the detector, we also have for free the spontaneous emission probability. Because remember that the detector had two levels separated by an energy gap, omega. If I substitute omega by minus omega, what am I doing? I'm swapping the excited and the ground state. Okay? So if we compute the vacuum excitation probability of a detector, which is the probability of going from ground to excited in the presence of the vacuum, this would be a function of omega. If we substitute omega by minus omega, we would get that the probability of going from excited to ground in the presence of the vacuum would be equal to probability of going from ground to excited in the presence of the vacuum minus omega. It just swaps the two levels. Everyone sees that? Questions about that? All right. So let's do it. OK, probability ground to excited in the presence of the vacuum. So luckily, we know how to compute probability of processes in quantum mechanics, no? We have a postulate that tells us, called Born's rule. So we get, let me just write the probability of going from, so I want to end up in an excited state for the atom. Yeah, I process it. In an excited state for the atom, and let's say an arbitrary out state for the field. And I have here
the ground state of the atom, the vacuum state of the field. I have time evolution between them. That's the probability of doing this transition using Born's rule. But I don't want to care about the state of the field in the end. I just want to care about the atom getting excited. So I need to sum over a complete set, complete basis of final states for the field. That clear? That's just Born's rule. That's the probability of going from ground to excited. I don't care about what state of the field I end up with. Okay? Right, so this thing we can expand as, let me just write this one first. I'm gonna write 0 E U dagger E out times out E U G 0. Okay? And computing this is a pain in general, because remember, U is the time evolution operator we can write as the time order exponential of integral of the interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture, which is what we're working on. And that thing is complicated. Because remember the interaction Hamiltonian, which is written there, the Andrew DeWitt Hamiltonian, second, the third line in there. That third line in here is complicated. We have a field operator, the dependents are complicated, time order exponentials of this are complicated. All right? Notice that I wrote here minus infinity to infinity. Sometimes you see here 0 to t in textbooks when they do like evolution in quantum mechanics. That is problematic when you want to do relativity. As we will learn here, and you will learn here firsthand, I think, how you switch on your interaction matters. If your interaction is switched on very suddenly, you're going to get some issues that may or may not be issues or realistic. But the thing is that this going from minus infinity to infinity is like, let's integrate over all time. How do I know it's a kind of an S matrix approach? How do I know that the atom only interacts for a finite amount of time? Well, because I have a switching function that has a support in a finite region. So the particular, if you want to write 0 to t, that's the particular case where the switching function is a top hat. OK, so if the switching function is a top hat from 0 to t, then you get the integrals with your limits here. So this just generalizes the case of writing a 0 and a t, or minus infinity and a t. That clear for everyone? So the finite time duration of the interaction is inside the switching function of the Hamiltonian. All right? Which introduces a lot of non-trivialities, as we will see in later days. OK, so this is complicated. But what we can do is to use perturbation theory. That we know. Let's compute a perturbative answer. And then we can do the most standard way, a Dyson expansion. So that means we write U as the identity, so nothing happens in no time, plus something of order 1, plus something of order 2, plus things that are of higher order in some parameter. In this case, let's pick lambda. By the way, if you do dimensional analysis, you will find out that lambda is dimensionless. So writing order lambda is OK. OK? All right. Yeah.
What if the dimension changes?
Then it's not dimension. In three dimensions, it's dimensionless. Then it's not. And then writing this is a little bit more dangerous. OK, we'll discuss this later, though, in a different note. In three dimensions, it's dimensionless. Of course, the dimension of the field depends on L. The dimension of the field is a power of L that depends on the dimensions of spacetime. Okay? But for three dimensions, that is dimensionless. So it's fine. We can use that as a parameter. OK, so you know what this is, huh? You've seen the Dyson expansion before, all of you? Has anyone not seen it? OK, good. U1 is minus I integral dt minus infinity to infinity h of t. OK? And that seems easy enough. Let's see if it's enough for what we want to compute. If that's the leading order contribution,
that thing, we can write as sum out 0g identity plus u1 plus order lambda square e out identity plus, oh, the daggers. All right, u1 plus order lambda square ground vacuum. All right, so the zeroth order term, the identity cancels immediately because ground and excited are orthogonal. Okay, so that term, the zeroth order, doesn't contribute. Now, the first order, the leading order contribution is going to be, it's going to be given by
what?
The first order contribution would be cross terms between 1 and u1. Those cancel as well because the u1 contributions we said cancel directly here. The u1, sorry, the identity contributions cancel already. So the first leading order term would be of the form u1 crossing with u1. That's order two. Agreed? We would have a same order term u2 crossing with identity, but the identity is zero on these states. So the leading order term here, it's going to be zero g u dagger one, sorry, u1 dagger, excited out excited, u1, ground zero, plus things that are of higher order. I can write cube. I actually know it's going to be fourth, but let's be conservative. Okay? Any questions about that? Again, to get there, just the one, the identity term is not there. You can remove it because G and E are orthogonal. And that's the first leading order term. All right. So we need to evaluate this. Well, let's. We know the Hamiltonian. So we have here, let's see, minus I times I, that's one. So we have the probability function of omega, and I'm going to write this as well, I should. D to E. Yes. All right. I have a sum over the out states that let me keep outside. I have, looking at the Hamiltonian, remember the Andrew DeWitt Hamiltonian with the switching function, third line on the top board. So we have a lambda square. All right, let me just write the lambda square here. Okay. Then we have a one that comes from the minus I times I. And then I get two time integrals. Okay. I also get a spatial integral. Let's see three dimensions. We can do it in n dimensions. Why not? I know that lambda is not dimensionless in a different dimensions, but let's just care about that later. So we have the x, that we have two Hamiltonians, so two integrals over x. Okay. What else do we have? We have two fields. Okay, so those are going to be integrals over k, because I'm going to expand in plane wave modes. But I'm not going to do it yet, because I want to write in terms of the Weinmann function of the field. So let me start writing the operator. So I have mu of t. So mu of t, I have the Hamiltonian is a product Hamiltonian, as you see. One operator for the atom, one operator for the field. That's nice, because that allows me to sandwich independently the atom and the field, okay, without a lot of complications. So I get the atom in the ground mu of t, the atom in the excited. Then I get the atom in the excited mu of t prime, the atom in the ground. Everyone happy with that? I have two Hamiltonians and just redistributing the terms. That comes from Hamiltonian number one, comes from Hamiltonian number two. Oh, mu is self-adjoint. Therefore, of course, there's no daggers in mu. And then we have the field here. Oh, I didn't write the smearing functions.
Okay, sorry about that. Mirroring function one, mirroring function two. Sorry, I forgot them. They're much nicer if put next to the x's, obviously. And then I have here the field 0, phi of tx out phi of tx 0. And usually I'm forgetting the exponentials. That's the way I remember I'm forgetting them, because another thing that makes more sense next to the detectors, but whatever. So I get I omega. Well, I'll evaluate. No, I don't have them because it's inside the T. Sorry, didn't say anything yet. All right, everyone, have I forgotten anything, people? Doesn't look like it, but then again, I tend to do it sometimes. Everyone sees how from here we get here. What we did is just we substituted U1 dagger by I dt ht and U by minus I dth of t. And then the h's are given by the third line on top, on the board on top, on the top blackboard. And that's what I get when I substitute it.
Is there no switching function?
Ha, I knew it. Well, I wanted not to, but thank you. Yes, I was forgetting something.
Could you just say which, because there is a reflection, so which line do you use?
The third one. Yeah, I know, reflection is on my way too. I had to guess it's the third one. No, it's the third one. It's the one that is lambda psi of t, sorry, chi of t, yeah. dx3. That's
the smearing function is not.
It's missing the smearing function. No, it's inside the mu. Okay, yeah, I didn't separate. Let me just write an m. Thank you. What happened right now? Let me write an m here, and let me define mu of t as f of x, m of t. All right? Everyone happy now? All right. Just to have the smearing function explicitly outside, and then work with something like sigma x in the interaction picture. All right, m of t is just sigma x in the interaction picture. Sigma plus e to the I omega t plus the Hermitian conjugate. All right, so observation here. We have a sum over a basis, complete basis of final states, and we have here a projector over that basis. What is that? Yeah, question?
Yeah, how do we define then mu as only a function of t when we have the smearing function, which is a function of x?
Because remember how mu is defined? Look at mu. Mu is defined as f of x times some operator, the second line. You see it? Can you see it by reflection or not?
No.
Yeah, that doesn't help.
Okay. And what was the question? The question was, why is mu only a function of t and there's a function of x on the right hand?
Oh, no, it's a function of x. Sorry. Then it's totally, you're totally right. Mu is a function of x. As I define mu of t, I didn't write it explicitly, but it is a function of x.
Okay.
Yeah. One has to compromise a bit with the notation or we will have super long length. But yeah, you're right. Okay. So next step, there's a sum over final state of the field, agreed? There's a sum over final state of the field, and I have a projector over all those states, or a basis of those states, agreed? That's the identity, that's the spectral decomposition of the identity. So this thing, together with this thing, is an identity. So we can use that to write this, p omega, and let's make sure I don't forget anything. Lambda squared. I don't have the sum anymore. dt prime. And then I can put the switchings here. All right. And I have also here, I can take out g m of t, e, and I have here the conjugate e m of t prime g.
So far, so good? I really want you to follow this calculation. So, because that way, I make sure that I didn't forget anything. OK, time to write the spatial integrals. Spatial integrals are dx n dx prime. And then I have two smearing functions. All right. And what is left is this little thing here. Everyone agrees, or I have forgotten anything. Doesn't look like it, but then again, it didn't look like it before. Everyone happy with this? OK. Do you recognize this object? Have you ever seen that object before? How many people have seen something like that before? OK, that's what we call the Weinmann function, also the two-point function of the field, the two-point correlator of the field, if you want. Now, this thing is easy to evaluate. Because remember, m, let me write it here, m of t is just sigma plus e to the I omega t plus sigma minus e to the minus I omega t. So evaluating this is easy. In here, the only thing, the sigma plus kills the excited state. So that doesn't contribute. The sigma minus transforms into the ground, so we get product one. So the only contribution we get is e to the I omega t for this one. Agreed? So let me write it here. Exponential of exponential of I omega t for that minus, right? Sorry, minus omega t. Sigma minus the excited and the excited states. And here we get the opposite, the complex conjugate. This is the conjugate of this. So this is the exponential of I omega t prime. Therefore, this whole thing is e to the I omega t prime minus c. Very easy to evaluate. Now, this thing here is what we call the vacuum Weinmann function. Weinmann was a person that worked in algebraic field theory. And among other things, you've seen Weak's theorem that allows you to write for Gaussian states any endpoint function as a two-point function by doing contractions. So this thing tells you already a lot about the theory. In fact, if the theory is Lorentz covariant, if the theory has the symmetries of the Poincaré group, there's a theorem by Weinmann, algebraic quantum field theory, that tells us that this has all the information about the quantum field theory. Okay? So the Weinmann function, the two-point correlator of the field, is an important object. It just appeared. Huh? Look at that. The transition probability of a detector coupled to the vacuum is proportional to an integral over the Weinmann function. Yeah?
So does that mean that for any QFT, if I know all of those, I know everything about my field?
If it's Poincaré, too. Yes.
Free field or also what?
Poincaré symmetries. That's the only requirement. The proof, I have to be honest, the proof in the papers by Weinmann are for free theories. But Weinmann argued that it's true for any theories. No one has found counterexamples. And people actually use in papers that that's true for interacting theories too, saying, Weinmann private communication. That's all the info I have.
Weinmann what?
Private communication, as in they told them. I can see problems when you work with interaction theories because you can get non-trivialities, things that you cannot define mode expansions and things like that. But it's algebraic field theories. You don't need to do that for that theorem. The theorem proof assumes free theories and Poincaré symmetry. All right. All righty. So I don't want to run out of time too much. OK, so this Weinmann function we can evaluate. I'm going to copy it because of time, but it's easy to evaluate. How do you evaluate? Well, substitute in this mode expansion. And as you can see, you're going to have vacuum here. The creation operator is going to, the annihilation operator is going to give you no contribution, only the creation operator. So pretty simple. Let me just copy the result. Just to make sure I don't make mistakes with it, because that would be bad. Here we go.
the Wyman function, it's equal to an integral over d to the n, k, to 2 pi to the n modulus, k. Yeah, the square root goes because you have two fields. You also get a delta. When you commute the a and a daggers, you get a delta canonical commutation relationship. You get a delta of k's that cancels one of the integrals. Good exercise, compute it. In fact, you will have to compute it, as far as I know. So this is just dx, yeah, that's right, e to the minus I modulus k t minus t prime minus k x minus x prime. All right. So not too complicated for the vacuum. I'm so looking forward to getting covariant with you and see what really happens here when you move arbitrary trajectories and all. But one step at a time. We need to go through the not so exciting stuff to get to the exciting stuff. All right, so we have that. Now we can write everything, and it's going to be so nice because we're going to get Fourier transforms. You see, this is integrated over all space. This is integrated over all the real line. We have a Fourier term here. And we have a Fourier term here. Well, we're going to put together this one with the other one. So let's do that. And because of time constraints, I'm going to do it one step. So watch me, meaning like if I make mistakes, tell me. The integrals over dt are Fourier transforms to a variable that is omega minus modulus k. No, plus would be, oh, why is it? Is that?
T and T prime are the other way around.
In here? Yeah, no, I know, but it shouldn't. This is a typo. That's the way it should go. Okay? So, these two things have the opposite signature. Good now. So, this thing, let me just write it as the modulus square of the Fourier transform. Let me just tilde it. The Fourier transform of the switching function to the variable omega plus modulus k. Everyone sees that? Okay. Now, we also get the integrals over space are also, oh, I'm missing the integral over k, sorry. This is for running. Integral over k, dn k, all right? Sum over all the modes of 2 pi n modulus k, all right? And now, Fourier transform modulus square of the switching function, omega plus modulus k. Good. Then we have modulus square, Fourier transform modulus square of the smearing. And the variable for the Fourier transform here is going to be just k. Well, minus k if you want. No, k, because it's the opposite definition, so minus k. But because it's multiplied by its conjugate, and because f we assume is real, then it's Hermitian symmetric property of the Fourier transform. So we can write just f of k square. And I think I'm not forgetting anything. Am I?
A plus or a minus in the...
It's a plus. These two things should have opposite signature.
It's a minus.
Oh, did I have it right at the beginning?
You had it right at the beginning.
Sorry. Sorry. Then there wasn't a typo. I'm glad because I copied it from a paper of mine. Okay. All right then. So this is the result that you get. Everyone happy with it? Very reproducible steps. Now, let's look at it. We have here that both the transition probability starting from the vacuum and the ground, the probability of getting an atom excited by emitting a photon, if you want, or also, if you substitute omega to minus omega, you get the probability of an atom spontaneously decaying and emitting a photon. Everyone agrees? Now, look at this and how fantastic this is. If you're switching function,
it's very long. So clearly, the James Cummings model predicts that it shouldn't happen, right? It should not happen that G0 transits to an excited state, right? That's what the James Cummings model says. Agreed? But look at this. This is non-zero in general. You have a switching function that has some supports, right? Localized in time, then that thing will be non-zero. Same for here. You have something that is localized in space, this thing will be non-zero. You integrate over all the modes. But let's see what happens. What happens if my switching is on forever, very long times? What is the Fourier transform of a homogeneous function? Homogeneous as in like doesn't vary. Constant for all times. What's the Fourier transform of that? It's a delta, right? So for long times, equals constant, then the Fourier transform of this as a function of a variable, let's call it omega. No, let's call it something else. What do we call it? Whatever, small omega. It's equal, is proportional to a delta of omega. Agreed? Huh. So if the switching is on forever, this term is an integral over a delta of an argument that is never zero. The gap of the detector is finite, and the modulus of k, the frequency of the field mode, is always positive. Agreed? When does this delta cancel? The argument of the delta cancel? Never. So in that case, probability omega is equal to zero in that case. So when the switching is on for very long times, you get no excitation probability from the vacuum and the ground state. Which kind of makes sense because the ground state is a global kind of, it's a global state. Like the vacuum state, if you actually interact with it for a long, 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 long time, you're kind of seeing truly that there's nothing in there. But what this is telling us is that you interact for a tiny little bit, for a small amount of time, and we will tell you, I'll tell you what scale is that, for a small amount of time, then you get some excitations. So this is kind of a reflection of the argument that people do hand wavily sometimes in, oh, if I have a magnifying glass and I look at the field in a short region in time and space, then I see a lot of particles popping up. It's true in the sense of particle detectors. Particle detectors will click if your extension in space and time, you know, the more localized in space this is, the less localized it is in frequencies. So your detector will have a higher probability of transition, thus the more you magnify the region, the less global your region is. Everyone happy with that? If the detector were also like extended through all space-time, you would also see nothing. Okay? Now, what happens with the excitation probability? With the excitation probability, the probability of getting excited, that thing is just swapping, it's everything the same, swapping omega with minus omega, so you would get here k minus omega, right, in this argument. Everything's the same. So if you do that, same here for switchings that are on forever, then this thing is the same thing. So the probability of minus omega has only a single contribution, right? You have a delta of modulus k minus omega. So in that integral over the, I haven't done the radial integral. I could have, anyway, because I didn't say what this is. That integral selects only modes that have a fixed frequency that is equal to omega. You see? If the switching is on forever and we're looking at the spontaneous emission, you get that the only contribution to the probability comes from a single mode, or well, a single frequency mode, which is what the James Cummings model was. What the James Cummings model was telling us, right? We have only a single mode. So only for switching that are long enough, only a single mode contributes to the dynamics. Everyone sees that? Because of this delta here. Now, it seems this is suggesting that the single mode approximation has to do with waiting for long times. Interactions that are on for a long time. As compared to what? Well, that's something we will discuss the next lecture, but before leaving, I just want to say one thing that is very important. the James Cummins model has two approximations in it, rotating wave approximation and single mode approximation. We will see this term here is a term that is purely counter-rotating, coming from purely counter-rotating, and we will discuss it the next day. This comes from purely rotating waves, so the ones that have the resonance implicit in it. Now, interesting enough, sometimes, correct me if I'm wrong, Aggie, because I'm going to make a statement about what some people do on average. Sometimes you see papers on archive, I have seen papers on archive, that tell you exploring physics beyond the rotating wave approximation. And they have a Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian they write is like James Cummins plus the two missing terms, but only one mode. Same thing, only one mode. They keep single mode, they relax rotating wave approximation. In here, it's clear that, well, we see that we recover something like James Cummins in the limit of long times, but we do not recover. There's no way, and that we'll argue the next day, there's no way to go halfway James Cummins. There's no way to do a rotating wave, a single mode approximation at the same time as you don't do the rotating wave approximation. If you do that, there is inconsistent approximations. The two approximations are based on the same fact. The interaction is long enough, and exactly with the same scale. So if you make a paper, you write a paper that tells me physics beyond rotating wave approximation, and then you do a single mode approximation, either you find that everything is the same, then I believe it, or you find new physics that I don't believe, because you're doing a wrong approximation. Because if the non-rotating wave terms are contributing to your dynamics, they also the other modes are, okay? So we will see that this thing of considering only a narrow peak distribution of modes around the resonant mode is only a good approximation in the same regimes that the rotating wave approximation is, okay? And that would end the discussion of comparing like what I would call textbook quantum optics. Have you seen that?
No, but I was wondering, is that true in a cavity?
Yes, it is true in a cavity. Now, in a cavity, it depends what cavity. If it's really, really short, but then for that to be, it's a better approximation in a cavity, but it's still bad, unless your cavity is really, really, really tiny. And then the scales play again. You need a cavity that is of the length of the wavelength of your transition. So less than atomic size. Not hundreds of times the atomic size. So for very small cavities, yes. But in free space, it's not. Okay. And we will, that's the last thing we're going to see about comparing light matter interaction. Then we have a little debate about it. And then we will make all the whole thing relativistic, because relativity hasn't played much of a role here. No one has changed reference frames or considered trajectories of detectors that are funny. This is kind of a stationary detector. This function, does the smearing function didn't depend on time or anything, right? So no relativity yet being explicit here, but we will see that the next day, which is tomorrow. All right, questions before I leave? Just please go over this and read it, because this calculation is very easy to follow. But, you know, it's a lot to write. So if you're copying, probably you were not focusing too much on the steps. It's super easy. And you're going to have to practice this. Either I always forget if it's a tutorial or an assignment.
One of them.
So you're going to have to do calculations like this. Nice. All right.